Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, it's a great pleasure to have Gwen Gordon on the podcast. Gordon began her career building Muppets for Sesame Street. Since leaving Sesame Street, Gwen developed Awakened Play, a play-based approach to making behavior change irresistible and transformation delightful. She has applied her insights in organizations ranging from San Quentin Prison to the MIT Media Lab and from IDEO to Pepsi Company. Along the way, Gwen has collected a master's degree in philosophy and an Emmy Award in children's programming. Her latest book is The Wonderful W, which is the first picture book for grown-ups. Hey, so great to chat with you today, Gwen.
Great to be here with you, Scott.
Is this the first, I just want to clarify something, is this the first picture book for grown-ups you've done or that ever in the history of the world?
Well, being a complete authority on the history of the world, I can say definitively, I have absolutely no idea. No, there have definitely been picture books for grown-ups. And it's actually not my first picture book for grown-ups. It's the first one I've published, though.
Okay, the first one you published. Well, cool. I mean, I loved it. I still do love it. I love it.
That's great.
Yeah.
I always love hearing that.
Well, let's talk about the plot a little bit of The Wonderful W, but you know, maybe we shouldn't give away like the ending or something because we want people to like buy it, right? So like the basic premise, you know, that we try all sorts. Well, you can tell me if my interpretation of the basic premise is correct after reading it, but that we try to fill our deficiency, our hole in our hearts up with so many of the wrong things that we think are going to fill us up that maybe only temporarily do so. And we very rarely, you know, we spend almost our whole lives avoiding ourselves and looking and examining what lies deep within. Is that a fair summation?
That's a really good encapsulation. I would add a few things, but I'm impressed.
Oh, thanks. No, feel free to add or modify or change. That's what I got from it. And, you know, it resonated so much with me because of, you know, I consider myself a humanistic psychologist, and the core philosophy of humanist psychology is becoming a whole person and living an examined life, you know. So I just resonated with me so much. It's such a wonderful book. So congratulations on it, by the way.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. One of my favorite teachers told me once that every strategy we have as personalities, adjusting, managing, negotiating our world, everything is actually fear of the void. Yeah. And the void being really the sense of our own, so sort of deep hunch about our, and this is a spiritual perspective, so, you know, this won't include everybody listening, I know, but it's the hunch that we actually don't exist as a solid, separate self. Yeah. And everything we're doing is trying to compensate for the sense of deficiency that comes from that basic lack of substantial self outside of our defenses against it.
It's so true.
That's a big leap.
Oh, no, it's an existential leap. It's great. Have you come across Irving Allum's work?
No.
Oh, you'd love it. You'd love it. He talks a lot about, you know, we have this need for belonging, but then there's like a deeper, like existential need for belonging. It's like there's actually Carl Rogers talked about this a lot too. You know, we have this like superficial need to belong, but then there's this other kind of like deeper awareness of the fact that we will always be separate no matter what we do, no matter what we engage ourselves in, no matter how much we try to associate with people to fulfill that need. There will always be this existential need because we are ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, die alone. It's not a very uplifting view.
Yeah,
but
it characterizes as existentialist very well. I think the book is really, and my own philosophy is not existential. I actually have had direct.
It's not as depressing.
No, it's not. And you know by the book that there's actually a way to
I know.
Experience wholeness. And it comes from really facing fully and experiencing without any resistance that sense of deficiency.
Yeah.
Like that's the doorway to the sense of wholeness. And that's the wonderful W, turning the holes into holes.
Well, reading your book made me feel better about my existence than reading Existential Philosophy, but I don't know who's more right. I hope you're right.
Well, that alone, that was worth it.
Yeah. Well, wonderful. You know, I'd like to back up a little bit and talk about, you know, you're such an interesting human being and have done so many varied things. I'd like to back up a second and go back to age 19 when you got your dream job. Tell me about that.
Oh, well, that was the job working for the Muppets. You know, there's a story about how I got the job. There's a story about being at the Muppets. What are you most interested in?
I want to know, like, what that time period, what was going on at Sesame Street at that time? Like, I want to know everything. Who did you interact with? Which Muppets did you meet? You know, did you meet Kermit the Frog? Did you have a conversation with Kermit the Frog? This is what I want to know.
Yes. Yeah. Well, those are very important questions, and I'm glad I can answer them. I have met Kermit the Frog quite intimately, quite like
intimately,
deeply. Yeah. I have performed surgery on Kermit the Frog. I've explored his inner world.
Oh my gosh. this is a G-rated podcast, Gwen.
Yeah. Well, it might comfort your listeners to know that he doesn't actually exist from the waist down.
Oh, okay. We don't want to put an explicit rating on this chat then.
Knowing him in the biblical sense is actually still quite superficial. Yeah. So there were only five. So when I came to Muppets, it was 1984, possibly three. And I'm terrible at dates. And I actually arrived. You know what? Actually, this is coming full circle. I got the job partly because of a puppet that I made that I had never made a puppet before. And I decided I would just try one. And I sent it. It was a big bird called Clyde. And I sent the bird as if he was applying for the job with a little note saying, you know what? Big Bird's my favorite role model. I'm ready to re-nest. Rock, you know. And then I got the interview. And what I brought to the interview was I wrote and illustrated a children's book for grown-ups, my first one, when I was 16, called I Think in My Last Life I Must Have Been a Rabbit. Mm. And it was for my college application. I actually was in Holland my senior year, and I wasn't that motivated to focus on my big, you know, college career. I was actually having a great time. And I thought, well, I'll write this book. And, you know, they got my test scores. I got everything else, but I'll write this book and I'll send it. And if I don't get in, I probably won't go to college. And it was my first choice, early decision school, actually probably Wesleyan, which is right near your alma mater.
Yeah.
So I got in, which, you know, luckily I would not have probably gone to school. It's my only college application. And I brought this book to my interview at Muppets and was wearing everything I wore I had made. So that got me the job. And at the time they were making Muppets Take Manhattan. So they
Nice. I love that. I love that movie. Yeah. Wait, did you work on that movie?
Yeah, I made the fish in the fish scene where they're throwing fish at the theater.
Yeah, of course.
So that was sort of the summer job, but in the fall, Sesame Street season goes from September to January. So they kept me in to work on Sesame Street, and Sesame Street only had a team of like four or five people. Let's see, maybe one, two, three, five people. So we were responsible for everything. Like, we would read scripts every week, and we'd, you know, make a list of all the things that were needed. And sometimes there were new characters that came in, and sometimes they were anything Muppets, you know, just like anonymous girl, you know, father.
Yeah.
And then sometimes they involved the classic characters in costumes, and sometimes there were props like Slimy the Worm's basketball court, or Snuffleupagus's nose flute, or a bunch of singing bananas, or that kind of thing. And we just would, rip through
bananas.
That list. Yeah, I made a chorus of singing bananas. And so, yeah, we would build stuff each week. And I was really lucky my first year. I got to design new characters because we just drew sketches when there were new characters and sent them up to Michael Frith, who's the art director, and he would choose the ones he liked. And my very first year, he chose my characters. So they were the Rockheads, these little rocks that would come alive when someone walked by them. So we would repair Kermit, we would repair, we would refurbish Grover. We were like, every time there was a shoot, we'd come bring the puppets back and clean them up and polish their eyeballs and call it a day.
Yeah, I just Google imaged the Rockheads and I'll put a picture up on the show notes. That's so
Is
cool.
Is there actually a shot of the Rockheads?
Oh, there's hundreds and hundreds. In fact, there's a whole Muppet Wiki page.
Oh my goodness.
About the Rockheads, a group of characters who lived on an empty lot on Sesame Street. They were created to teach the concept of what is alive and what is not. Is that true?
Levy, I have to Google now to see if they're the same ones, because who knows, maybe later on they were like...
Well, I'll just put in your chat window the link.
Oh, good. Okay.
They appeared in episode 1939, where they tried to decide how many of them there would be if one of them left, with David teaching them subtraction to figure out. At the end of the same episode, they provide a rock concert doing their own rendition of the Sesame Street theme. Is this ringing a bell at all?
Those episodes weren't shot when I was there for... Oh, there we go. Excuse me. Yeah, those are my characters.
Yay!
Oh my God!
Yay!
That's too funny. Yeah,
yes.
Those were that was my very first year. I was 19 years old. And I created and designed these little...
Well, they should give you credit on the wiki page. They link.
Nobody gets individual credit.
Oh, okay.
It's always just...
Well, you're getting credit stuff now, because it's on the record now at the Psychology Podcast.
Oh, Ed Christie. No, it actually gave credit to... Oh, that's funny. It gives credit to Ed Christie, who did not design and build them. He absolutely did not.
That is not cool.
I have been ripped off.
Yeah, that is actually not cool. So
I love Ed. Yeah. He's a wonderful, wonderful person.
Yeah,
build those puppets.
Okay. Yeah, good. Well, we're going to correct the record right now. We love doing that on the Psychology Podcast. So let's move on in your life. Then you designed computer PlayStations for children. Is this before computers were computers?
Well, no, this was like, let's see, 85, 86.
Oh, wow.
This was after Muppets. So it was the heyday of the Media Lab, you know, when interactive multimedia was exploding onto the scene. And Marvin Minsky, who's the sort of father of artificial intelligence, and Alan Kay, one of the Apple luminaries, were there. And I felt like Forrest Gump. I was like getting to be in all these places with the originators and the stars of the field. So Alan Kay was our advisor for the Vivarium. It was an Apple research group that was exploring how to teach children about animal behavior. And there was a master's thesis project in that lab, and they wanted to create this big furry computer PlayStation. This was when the Apple IIgs was...
Oh my gosh, that was my first computer.
Yes, yes, yes. So I ended up developing on the IIgs even after that. I remember hearing that from you. So,
you heard that from me?
Well, I was, you know, listening to some interviews that you did.
Did I mention at some point? Because that was my first computer.
Did.
Oh, I've talked about it before.
Yes.
I don't remember talking about it before, but that's so cool that you heard that. But yeah, that was my first computer. And my grandma bought it for me because she wanted to, she thought that I would take to it. And I instantly took to it. I actually started programming games on it. I programmed this game called Mystery, but I still have saved. I have the Apple IIgs in my basement. I wonder if it's worth something. I wonder
what
if it's worth
relic.
Something now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were trying to, the computer was housed inside the creature's stomach. You can actually do another Google search for Noobie, Noobie.
Okay.
MIT Media Lab. It was in Stuart Brand's book. So it's this
wonderful
creature, and they wanted Muppets to make it, to build it for them, but they were coming into some problems with the IP. And so the workshop, I had moved to Cambridge by then, and the workshop leader, Jim Morrison, his name, he sent them to me. He just said, Gwen will build it. Just, you know, she's there, no problems. So I just became part of the team, and I was building this big creature. And then I also did all the animations, because it was basically like a huge Mr. Potato Head that you just squeeze the different body parts, and an animated version would appear on the screen and cycle through whatever different kinds of those, you know, body parts. Where there's if you're squeezing the hand, it might become a claw or, you know, a fin or any number of things. So you could create your own animals by sight, like Mr. Potato Head, and then find out how they survived in different environments. And that was the way children learned. And so I did all the animations and the user and all the UI, and you know, just got into that world. And then after leaving the lab, the woman whose master's thesis that was, and I started a company called Telltale Technologies, and we were creating other kinds of alternative input devices, mostly stuffed animals, because that seemed to be what I could do. So yeah, that was that chapter.
Oh, cool. You're such an interesting person. So let's move on. You know, you got a master's degree in philosophy. I was wondering, how have you applied philosophy? Do you apply it in your work?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was really like, you know, all these different seeds that were there as a child. I was, you know, even at Muppets, I was taking critical theory classes at night at the New School. While I was, so I'd be constructing Muppets during the day and deconstructing them at night. And thinking really critically about what are we really doing? What messages are we conveying with these characters that we're not necessarily conscious of? You know, Kermit being a reptile, you know, as the leader, a cold-blooded, like essentially green male, white male, and the mayhem that he's able to hold, and that the feminine Miss Piggy is like femininity, femaleness occupies the entire landscape of her personality.
Wait, have you met Miss Piggy?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I had such a crush on Miss Piggy when I was 5 years old. I've never admitted that to anyone before.
Wow, I think you might be rare.
Really?
Miss Piggy is slightly designed to repel or scare men.
You know, I never knew that. I missed that memo. I thought she was, like, really fierce.
Well, you're in luck because she is an archetype, and I'm sure that many women carry that, so you might be able to find it somewhere.
That's hilarious. Okay.
Anyway, so I was...
Anyway.
Even at the media lab, I was very much, wasn't just happy making. I am happy making, but I am also really a thinker. And so I was asking difficult questions and, you know, like, is this really good? How do we know this is, you know, what we're doing is really of service? And anyway, so it was like a wonderful thing to be able to finally focus my full attention on the question, the philosophical questions that I always had.
Good.
So that really, what that did was it shifted me from just being a creator to being reflecting on creating and reflecting on the deeper principles that apply to a creative life. And that's when I started actually looking to understand play, or I wasn't really looking to understand play. I had a deep intuition about play, like that it had a potency that was beyond the way it'd been, you know, characterized and trivialized in our Protestant work ethic, you know, culture. So I was drawn, studying philosophy sharpened my tools for cracking the nut that I had always had around the sense of what is this power of play. And so that definitely shifted my life. After studying philosophy, I started teaching about, I also studied cosmology and was looking at deeper evolutionary principles and just the question of ultimacy, you know, through different lenses. Like what are the ultimate physical principles from a cosmological perspective? What are the ultimate philosophical principles? What is happening here? And what are we here for? And how do we participate fully in this 17 billion year old universe that gave rise to us? And, you know, just what is life for and about? And and what does play have to do with that?
So, what's the answer?
42.
I don't have to do any more podcast episodes ever again. I got it.
We're a full service podcast interview.
Well, how you applied your work to lots of domains. I mean, how do you help Weight Watchers, you know, with play? Like, can I play my way to lose 50 pounds?
We're really bouncing around. Yeah.
It's all connected. It's all connected.
It is. It absolutely is. So I was glib when I said 42, of course, but it's obviously you were not entirely serious about the question. And it's,
of course,
you know, it's something I've unpacked a lot and how it applies. So I've been looking at, well, what are the insights that I've got? How can I apply the insights that I've gotten about power of play? And with Weight Watchers, I was brought in to help create a more playful meeting experience and to help socialize the whole organization around the value of play, you know, which has historically been, since they're also very rooted in hard science as, you know, as rationale for everything they do, they hadn't really caught up on the hard science of play. And they always thought of play as something that was versus everything they were trying to do. And I was really shifting their perspective to see it as via everything they were trying to do.
Yeah. And did you do that with Pepsi? Is that what you did with Pepsi as well? And AARP and, you know, basic, that was the basic theme of what you were brought in for?
No, each one was really different. AARP was Hatching Their Hatchery, which is their innovation think tank. They're now well known for it. They took a big leap and brought themselves fully into a 21st century innovation culture with this beautiful space called the Hatchery to innovate new products and ideas. And I was brought in to do some workshops on one of the principles for innovation, which was fresh, how to bring in fresh thinking. That was just a workshop and training and support in their general project of innovation culture. And PepsiCo was, I was brought in really almost purely as a thought leader on play, because they had an entrepreneurial venture called Wello, which they were developing for women over 50. So I had just hit 50. So I was like in their
congratulations.
That was like 5 years ago. Do the math. And I had done a Kickstarter for a film I was producing about play. And so they wanted me to sort of be the face of their culture, the play culture that they were cultivating for their market. So I would go, instead of sponsoring events for that population, they wanted to create experiences for those events. So I'd go to conferences and gatherings and offer these play workshops, and they were sponsored by Wello, which cool. was PepsiCo.
Very cool. I'm sure they benefited greatly. I wonder if it benefited the taste of the Pepsi product at all.
Yeah, this was actually a non-sugar based.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's always, it's a complex world.
It is. It is. Well, there's lots of moving pieces of each organization.
Yeah. The women who were spearheading this were really, actually, really had a shared sense, as I do, of what health meant and well-being.
Sure.
So there wasn't a tension there. There was within the larger organization, but not within the group that I was part of.
Cool. Probably was more fun to work with that part of the group. Just wanted to take this moment to thank you all for your support of the podcast over the years. It's been a real privilege to do this podcast for you all for the past 4 years. It's been a real labor of love. If you'd like to further support the podcast, I wanted to let you know a few things you could do to help make it a better experience for you all. First, I'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. This would help make the show more prominent on iTunes and increase our listenership. I believe you can subscribe both on your iPhone and on your computer. Second, it'd be great if you could give the show a rating and review in iTunes. I definitely read all the reviews, and they're helpful to others who are thinking about giving the show a listen. Another thing you can do is donate something to the show. Even just the price of a cup of coffee would really help me continue to do this podcast for you all. To donate something, you can go to thepsychologypodcast.com and click on the link at the bottom that says Become a Sponsor. So thanks again for your incredible support of the show over the years. You know, I do this show for you all because I truly love sharing my enthusiasm and love of the mind, brain, and creativity, and I really appreciate you joining me on this journey. Okay, now back to the show. So how can play save the world? I mean, you talk about how you believe in the, quote, the gospel of play. So do you view yourself as an evangelicist? Wait, how do you pronounce that word?
Evangelist.
Do you view yourself as an evangelist of play?
You know, it's actually evolved a lot since I was, you know, spreading the gospel of play. What I've seen is that the play message is actually getting mainstream attention. And I don't know if you can hear my pug coughing, but apologies for all random.
How was your pug? It sounded like a human.
It's a pug.
Your pug is like, whops a lot of power there.
Oh, dear. I'll try to cover the mic.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, so I used to be sort of passionately spreading the gospel of play because I knew that it was a fundamental force and primal survival drive, but also evolutionary drive. So it seemed to me that this was the way, not only that we would find balance and reduce stress and, you know, all and generate creativity, all the benefits that play confers, but it was also like our potentially our, it was an expression of our true, I'll say true nature, like humans, Homo ludens are inherently playful. So it was like a sort of deeper, you know, let us be humans, like let's connect to this deep life-affirming drive. And that's a very particular lens for play that, because it's been so pressed, so suppressed, and so, you know, we are so play deprived as a such individualistic and competitive. And I mean, I like to call it the proving ground. We've left the playground. We've landed on either a proving ground or a battleground. And I wanted to restore the playground.
Yes.
And yet what I found, what I really saw was, you know, that message at one point was really important because it countered this strong tendency to elevate seriousness as if it's the same as value. And there were just a lot of messages that it felt important that play could counter that would restore some balance. But what I started to see was, as you know, after Stuart Brown's book, which was New York Times bestseller on play, and it started to diffuse into the system, it started to get co-opted by every agenda. You know, you had,
that's what happens.
Yeah. And so organizations were like, we're going to get use play to become more productive. And we have it used as, you know, it's a great stress reliever. Charlie Hoehn's work is wonderful. But it's, it was sort of utilitarian, like, and you could see that, you know, there's a shadow side to play. Play is not always
really
not life affirming. Oh, yeah.
No, I'm just joking. Yeah. I know there is.
So, yeah. So I actually started writing to felt like the movement had gone far enough that it required some reflection and some distinctions about what kind of play actually transformed proving ground mindsets into playground mindsets, and what kinds of play reinforce it. You know, like putting a ping pong table into a game room at a corporation, which is cutthroat and competitive, isn't going to necessarily turn it into this, like, you know, joy, life affirming, joy filled playground. It's like you can use any play, any kind of play from a mindset of proving and battling, and that it won't necessarily shift the mindset. So I was looking at the play that reinforces it, the play that opposes it, the play that reforms it, and the play that transforms it. And they're really different. And then I even went further and was looking at, well, I've had play groups and I was working with people who just wanted to play more. And what I saw was that inevitably you'd find blocks, right? So, you know, at first there'd be like a wild animal released from captivity. Wow, I get to play, permission and games and structures and some safety and awesome, like freedom. But eventually, you know, you'd start to see the backlash and the blocks and the proving ground, the fears and the places, basically, because play is freedom. It's like any place in which we weren't free started to show up. And even the backlash of shame of like, oh, I shouldn't have done that, or inhibitions. And as I a first layer was to play with the blocks to play, which helped. You know, whatever, it's like taking the part of us that's free and using it to help liberate the parts that aren't. But it, essentially, eventually it gets to the parts that are just can't play with the blocks to play and just need holding and just need the soothing and like the space to be with fairly difficult emotions. And so it became a bigger journey around, well, how do we get to liberate the playground? People said that they're living on a playground became really like, how do we heal ourselves at the deepest level? Because those are the places where we're not playable, where life isn't play. So in order for life to be play, it really is the path to wholeness. It's like facing all the parts that don't feel capable of playing, and using play, the playful part of us, as a resource, you know, to the extent that we can.
Beautiful. I love your articles about that, about how not all play is transformative and how we can, as you say, restore the playground because you say the playground is our true habitat.
Yeah.
But, you know, in kind of when you talk about these principles or these ways that play can reinforce, reform, oppose, or transform, I really like this notion of a single like guide to when it is transformative, that being how much does it feel like you're going against the inertia of who you are and the world or going against it. I really like that metaphor. You say, quote, it's just a heck of a lot more fun to play tug of war than it is to be at war with the world. What a great summation of maybe a compass for understanding when your play is being transformative versus when it's coming from a place of deprivation, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, and the whole idea of being able to play tug of war, play with that battling energy versus sort of merging with it and just acting from it. I mean, that's a really powerful step toward freedom. And actually what Stephen Porges, the neurobiologist, was the first articulator of the whole vagal system as a third part of the nervous system. Are you familiar with that? The whole vagal?
No, I'm really, the vagal. Yeah, I absolutely am. Yeah. Like Barbara Fredrickson has done some good research on that topic. Yeah.
Stephen Porges wrote a big tome called Vagal Theory. Anyway, he describes play as sympathetic arousal without fear. So that's why you see like chase play and fighting play and tug of war play in animals. It's like all the basic sympathetic arousal, fight, flight, right? But without fear, where all that tension gets released without the trauma response, without it being a trauma response. So when sometimes I'll just like tap my partner, Tony, and say, chase me. Chase me. And it's like, oh, the joy. It's like this primal release, right?
Just chase.
Or when you're, you know, ready to fight with somebody, like, what would it be like to just shift to, you know, play fighting and just get that tension out? And that's the mastery. That's like being able to play with those activated states versus having to live in a world that's full of threat. And
yeah.
Like it turns the world into a playground, and then the threat is something playable.
I love it. Adult play really doesn't get nearly as much attention as childhood play, and childhood play doesn't get as much attention as it should. You know, so all that is true. What I just said.
Yeah.
But oh boy, you know, I just love the spotlight that you're shining on this. Well, you know, it's funny because we shouldn't be ending this podcast with this question. We should have started with it, but. What is play? I mean, you wrote a whole paper that I found fascinating outlining the inherent paradoxes of play and how we should define it. So, like, how do you define it?
Well, I'm going to give you a couple of quick ones, quick answers. So, you know, play has in the Oxford English Dictionary, I think over 23, it might be 23 definitions.
Yeah.
And one of the ones I really like is movement. Like a rope has play if it has wiggle room. If it's not rigid. So the opposite of play is rigidity.
Oh, nice. I like that. Yeah.
And I think of the movement as the, you know, flexible response to whatever it's time for, like the capacity to respond to whatever it's time for. I'll go with that for now.
Wow.
Yeah. So what is play is probably my least favorite question. Like everyone wants to know, and I hate answering it. Like, I just find it, you know, because I had to go into a post-rational mode in order to actually get moved toward it. And I just find that that's not an easy zone to enter.
Okay. So you've written multiple articles. I've read all your articles in preparation for this interview. You wrote a great article about how play is essential stepstone to healthy childhood development. So can you maybe talk about why?
Sure. Well, so it's actually two angles. One was that I wanted to understand playfulness.
Yeah.
Like, where does playfulness come from? Why are some people more playful than others? What can we do about it? Is it just like a happiness set point where you just start to luck out? Because playfulness confers all these wonderful advantages in life, just like happiness does. And they're very related, of course. But I was looking at, well, how does our worldview get shaped, you know, really so that we can see the world as a playground? And can we do anything about it if we aren't inherently playful? So that was my interest. And so I was looking back at, well, where do worldviews come from? what are the early experiences that shape how we see ourselves and whether the world is safe or not? And because we play to the extent that we feel safe.
Yes.
So assuming that everyone would naturally be playful to some extent, I mean, differently with different styles and different, but in that essential way of like have of the freedom to respond to what's needed in each moment and to be able to have their full expression in relation to as much of life as possible, which is another way to see play. I was interested in what are those experiences. So I saw that, you know, the earliest experiences are the ones that are have the biggest impact on our sense of safety.
Okay.
And of course, attachment is, you know, our first universe is the relationship with our caretaker. So, you know, this is basic attachment theory that we, our internal working models, right, are created by the quality, the level of security of that attachment bond. And what I saw was that, you know, if you have an insecure attachment bond, if like, let's just start with the most insecure, a disorganized attachment, then you're likely to see the world as a prison. Like the world is fundamentally unsafe. There's nothing that we're not empowered. The best we could do is just, you know, just manage ourselves. And I mean, with disorganized, it's even difficult to do that. So it's like everything is threatening. We don't have the capacity to regulate enough even to do that. So it's very difficult for life to be play.
Yeah.
When life is a prison. Then the next stage, you know, an insecure attachment, avoidant, would be that life is a battleground, that everything's a threat. So it really has to do with the security reflects the degree of threat that we perceive as the world. And the degree of threat and security give rise to the level of play that we are capable of. So when we see the world as when we got that insecure, intermittent, when the attachment caregiver was, you know, inconsistent, not emotionally or even violent, then the world is a threat and we feel like we live in a battleground and we perceive threat where it doesn't exist. So we're defended. So we actually, you know, we create the reality. So of course, you know, you meet someone who's defensive and you're less likely to be friendly to them. And so the world actually shows up as threatening. You know, defensive people are scary. So you get scared. And so defenses escalated. So you end up in a world that really feels like a battleground because you're seeing it that way and it's actually playing out to be that way. I'm really simplifying, as you know, and your listeners are sophisticated and will.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just so clear that you really love thinking about play in a really, really broad, holistic sense of its impact on the whole system of human nature, not, like you said, how it's been co-opted, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to just complete because when you see just the idea that when you do have secure attachment, then the world can be a playground, you know, that then we can see realistic risk. We can perceive it as when it's realistic. It's not like suddenly a Pollyanna and everything is play, but we can sense when there is risk. And it's safe to have adventures. It's safe to express ourselves. It's safe to connect. And that makes, you know, gives us more playmates. And new experiences, ambiguous experiences aren't threatening. So the ambiguity and the unknown that is so much an inherent part of life is actually considered full of possibilities rather than full of threat.
Yes. And, you know, Abraham Maslow talked about defense versus growth. And,
yeah,
you know, we limit our growth so much from erecting our defenses. And we need to get, play is a great way to get out of the comfort zone, right?
Yeah. Well, and we can play when we have enough security. So we take the level of security that we have and we can grow it by playing more.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. I love it. I mean, you do talk about, you know, getting out of our boxes to enable creativity to flourish. You say the way you phrase it is by changing the preset radio station or turning the radio off altogether so that something new is possible. I feel like quoting you is enhancing this episode.
Yeah, I'll shut up so you can just tell me what I said.
Because You know, like you've said on the record so many beautiful things, right? That, yeah.
And that goes right to your work on default mode networks, right?
It sure does. And that's the seed of a lot of the psychological play for sure.
But isn't it, I mean, I was thinking about this because I did my research too, and I listened to a whole bunch of your talks and interviews, podcasts, and it was really interesting because I started thinking about, well, default mode network can just be a box, right? Yeah. It's our identity. It's our in a default in sense of self, right? So that can just be the old radio station playing over and over again. Most of the thoughts that we have that when we're not focused on something else in a different part of our brain are just habitual identity creating thoughts.
Yeah.
Identity thoughts. And that's why, like, you know, psychedelics, where the default mode network gets quiet and something new can happen, that's really getting out of the box.
Yes.
Or like at the end of my, like the way that the book, well, come full circle to the wonderful W, because the way that I wrote that initial seed for that story 10 years ago. And because I had this intuition and it was playful. I had a friend who lost her W in her welcome sign and I wanted to give her a gift. I gave her a W and I was thinking, oh, hole and hole. Like she should, what would happen if she fell into a hole? She'd need a W. And, you know, I had this feeling of like, there's something really interesting about the relationship between holes and holes with a W. So I was playing with that and I wrote her a story and gave her a W for her birthday. And that was 10 years ago. And I didn't quite know how the story ended. And I was trying to figure out, how does the princess find her W? Where did she, really, where, like, where do we get our W's?
Yeah.
And I ended up going on a retreat with a meditation retreat, a silent retreat for 6 days. And I started, as I got quieter and quieter, my mind became lucid. And I know I have this tendency when I get more and more lucid to like go, oh, good, my tool's sharp. Let me take it to some good problems. And so I was like, started thinking about things, you know, I get quiet and then I go off and think about things. And I ended up like filling 69 pages of my journal on this retreat, writing 3 children's stories. And then like, there's this other conventional book about play that I was writing. I was like, oh yeah, I've got all this. And then I finally, like, it's almost like I, you know, your identity starts to loosen, the default mode network gets quieter. It's like new ideas come. And I'm thinking of it as like in the ozone layer, when you get real, if you were like to travel out and you, or expand and you get really close to that final layer of your atmosphere of your habitual self, like right there at the edge where the ozone's really thin and you're starting to get like, you know, I was sticking antennas out into the like, universe from my ozone.
Yeah.
I get all this stuff, right? And I called it absoluting because you're that outer zone is like the absolute and I would just loot it. From my personality was still intact. But it was thin and it was, you know, quieter. But I just grabbed these big buckets of stuff that I get like from the absolute, but all the answers to my question. And I would go back and fill my journal. And then at a certain point I remember thinking, wow, this journal looks like everybody else's journal and my name isn't on it. What if I lose it? What if this, you know, like this is some good stuff in here. And I started to like go, oh, my ideas, you know, which is the opposite of what's happening in meditation, right? Loosening of identification. And I had this impulse, like, I just want to write my name on my journal so I won't lose it.
Yeah.
Started to write my name. You may not end up keeping this story in the podcast, but and I as I wrote my name, basically my whole identity just contracted right back.
Sure.
And I was like, okay, I'm letting it go and I'm just going to let it go. And then I'm going to put my journal in my room and I just finally was like, it's not worth it. Like Gwen being a Gwen is not better than what's possible if I really let that default mode network go, like got quieter.
That's very Buddhist of you.
It was a Buddhist retreat. And I did, and it was open, and I was like, ah.
Wonderful.
That's the W.
That's the W. And was this an inspiration for the book you wrote?
It was for the ending of the book. It's like I had to figure out how it ended.
I see. Yeah. Which we won't really explicitly
know the essence of it.
Yeah. But, you know, maybe they can fill in the blanks, but it's definitely worth getting. Well, thanks so much for imparting your wisdom on play for us today. I'm going to end with another one of your favorite quotes. Play is life force itself. When we can sense and amplify its most life-affirming, transformative impulses, it will point us directly to the playground. Thank you so much for chatting with me today, Gwen.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.